Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good day and welcome to the New Books in Music podcast. I'm your host today, Steve Lee Nash. Today I'm joined by James Cook. James is the author of the book Memory Songs, a personal journey into the music that shaped the 90s, which is out now and published by Unbound. The book details the author's own adolescent musical obsessions, from the Beatles to John Barry, from Led Zeppelin to the Waterboys, that led him to form his own band Flamingos, move to London, and begin the long and often perilous road to becoming a full-time working musician. The book is part memoir, part music criticism, part social history. It's my pleasure to welcome James to the podcast. Hi, James.
Hi, Steve.
Thanks. Good to hear from you, man.
Yeah, no, good to be on the show. Thank you for inviting me.
So I feel there that my introduction probably didn't even scratch the surface of who you are and what you've done, what you've achieved. So please tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it was all there. The book is kind of quite a hard sell because it's a number of different things. It's a sort of hybrid of a memoir. And I hesitate to say music criticism or music analysis, but you've got that sort of strand going through. So what it basically is, it's a memoir of the 80s and 90s told through favorite or significant songs. So you've got the first part, which is set in the 80s, and you've got chapters on, say, Bowie, the Beatles, Roxy Music, and then you go to part two, which is in the 90s, and you've got chapters on the Manic Street Preachers, Sway, Pulp. So you've got all the music that fed into this era, which, you know, for want of a better umbrella term, let's call Britpop, the early to mid 90s, all this music was sort of feeding in, and there was a sort of culmination or apotheosis at that point where sort of everything was focused on London, and that's where the band that I formed with my brother, Flamingos, my twin brother, I should say, Jude, we were around at that time making records. So we we took part, but we were peripheral. I always say we were a footnote on a footnote, which is not to sort of denude how serious we were, but it's a kind of first-hand account of being there at the time. That's kind of what the book evolves into.
Well, that's good as well. And, you know, it's interesting because there's a line that I pulled out of the book, which talks about the peripheral, being on the peripheral of your evolving lives. But Sometimes being on that periphery is where the most interesting stories are found, which I've kind of like a line that I pulled out of the book kind of as a summary of the entire book itself, really.
Yeah, I think so. I think with it's very different to sort of, you know, the memoir strand of the book is very different to your usual rock memoir, because you know the narrative arc, you know what happens. They're in obscurity, they make it big, they do loads of drugs, they implode, and then there's redemption. With this, because we weren't a big band by any means, you have a sort of a slightly different arc. You know, there's a sort of we make an album, which is our own kind of, you know, sort of our ambitions have been sort of satisfied by that. It's a different thing. It's not, you know, you're not reading the book. It's not, the point of the book isn't that it's by a famous person. That's why you read the book. I think when I started writing it, I was more interested in ideas around music. And then I realized that there was a pretty good story.
I do have a bunch of questions about your time in Flamingos, which are coming up later. But let's just pull focus on the title for a second, because it's called Memory Songs. So what is actually a memory song? How would you describe that?
Yeah, I was asked this once before, very early on, and it's difficult to describe it because it's not just, I mean, a song that you have known in the past will bring back memories. Any old song will do that. What a memory song is really is a song you've had in your life as sort of part of the mental furniture for a long time. So ideally you hear it first in your teens or early 20s. And as you go through different phases of your life, it's sort of with you. So it kind of helps to be old. The older you get, the better it is, because you get this sort of, I think I describe it as a sort of hierarchy of meanings that the song has to you. So, for instance, you might like a band or a record song in your teens, and then you sort of move away from it, you forget about it, and then suddenly in your 20s, you have this really intense phase where you play it again, and then maybe in your 30s, there's another phase. So you're sort of building over in layers like an old master canvas, you know, but the initial connection you have with that song, it might be hard to get to, is always there. If you kind of listen to it, it can be hard to locate, but if you listen to it with one ear, as it were, if you know what I mean, there at the core of the song. And this, I found this idea fascinating, because these songs, if they're any good, they endure and they become part of your life, and I wanted to sort of investigate that and how songs like that affect people.
Well, it's a really interesting take, and I found this book to be particularly interesting because I have a similar sort of take as you, but my sort of side of things is film, and I think there's a case to be made for memory films. You know, when I was a kid, there's so many movies that I watched as a kid that I still resonate with me now. Gosh, even yes. Though some of them are pretty problematic films, you know, so they haven't aged well in this day and age, but for some reason they still stick with you, and that's definitely the case with music too. But yeah, one of the reasons I was so interested in this book was because, you know, music has played a big part in my life, but so has film as well, in that kind of memory sense. So yeah,
I mean, I Close Encounters of the Third Kind the other day, which I'd first seen in sort of 1978.
Yeah.
And you know, over the years, especially if you become a parent, you know, a film like that has these different layers of resonance, you know. And that's a really interesting idea. I mean, but with songs, it's slightly more obvious, because music and the sense of smell are the two things I think that really connect us with the past, you know.
Absolutely. So in the first part of the book, which details your kind of your adolescence to teenage years, your first kind of music that you were that really took you was the Beatles. So tell us about this moment when you first heard the Beatles. I believe it was the White Album. Is that correct?
It wasn't. It was Revolver, actually.
It was Revolver. Sorry about that. Yeah. And so just tell us the importance of hearing Revolver for the first time.
It was an odd one because my parents, my dad was, he just listened to classical music. That was, you know, fair play to him. Pop was the enemy. He just didn't get it yet. In my dad's record collection, there was one pop album, and that was Revolver, which was in there by accident. It had been at their wedding reception, and someone had been sent out to, there was Brahms or something on the dance set. Someone had been sent out to buy a pop album, any pop album. And they came back with Revolver, which was, you know, it's pretty good. It's a pretty good sort of random choice to come back with. So this was the one record, and I got into the record by looking at the sleeve. I thought, this is a really interesting sleeve. It's very different to all the other, the Rhine scenes, you know, and all the kind of the other classical records. So not knowing anything about the Beatles, and I must have been about 12, I started playing this record with my brother, because it's a sort of joint experience. Being twins, you know, we kind of discovered things jointly. So we played this record, And it was a very strange record. It was extremely bizarre, different styles, although, you know, accessible. And this was a couple of months after that, John Lennon was shot. So I had this experience of just getting into this group without really knowing who they were, and then suddenly having to backtrack and finding out all this information about how, you know, that they were the sort of the major cultural force of the 60s and the biggest band in the world.
And also, as well, I mean, obviously this is way pre-internet, and so finding out about bands at this time was actually really difficult, right?
It was difficult. Yeah, I touch on this in the book. It was difficult but exciting, I think, and more exciting because you had to get on the bus and go out and spend some money and discover these things. So it became the prize when you came back home with it was sort of more, was worth more, I felt, even though it was frustrating. You couldn't, and I mentioned in Memory Songs as well, that if you were really into an artist, you know that feeling when you're really just, you're hungry for more information about them, and you want more records, and you want to know what they look like. I mean, something with Led Zeppelin, in the following chapter, I had no idea what they looked like because, I mean, they had a willful anonymity to their product, but it was hard to find out what the damn group looked like, because it was, nowadays you just obviously just, you know, a couple of clicks away,
yeah,
and you binge on their fan sites all day. But so yeah, it was more difficult, but in a way more exciting, I thought.
So the book also goes into some great length about David Bowie and the influence that he had on you. So so what impact did the Thin White Duke have on you as a teenager?
He was, I mean, I was aware of him as well. This was the strange thing, because concurrently, he just, in early 80s, he just, you know, had a huge serious Moonlight tour. So he wasn't, he, you know, he was a mainstream artist. You know, there he was with the perm, the blonde hair, and doing, you know, playing Milton Keynes. And I didn't really have a sense of him as someone who'd been a transgressive artist, someone who was channeling all these reference points, quite in the same way that Brian Ferry was at that, you know, at his Avalon stage. You know, you spin back 10 years, and there he is singing Ladytron in a tiger stripe Lurex bomber jacket. I mean, they're not the same man almost. But with Bowie, it was kind of you know, this huge artist, but a big, you know, canonical multi-million selling artist, but had also done all this interesting stuff. And he would lead you back to other people, and that's something else that I mentioned. Portal, a so-called portal artist, who is a portal to, you know, Bowie, quite sort of easily leads you back to, you know, Warhol and Velvet Underground, and you know, esoteric writers, the Beats, you name it. You know, he was like a teacher figure, really important. I mean, I had friends. It was sort of the Bowie was their artist, so I couldn't get quite as near to him as I'd like. I couldn't quite make him my own, but he was still a really important force, especially as he was doing, you know, sort of transgressive stuff within the pop media.
And so, as the book is called Memory Songs, I feel we should dive a little bit into the content and discover what kind of memories some of the songs that you discuss in the book provoke. So let's start with This Is the Sea by The Waterboys.
Clearly, just to sort of spin back, we can see here that my tastes were hopelessly Catholic. I was just, you know, into so many different, you know, where do the Waterboys fit with David Bowie? And then the Triffids, which is the next chapter. But it was a kind of patchwork of things I was pulling together. I mean, maybe the Waterboys not so much, because Mike Scott in that time before he went to Ireland was very much influenced by Bowie and the Clash, Patti Smith. You know, so these things fed into the more rock side. And with a song like This Is the Sea, it was such a powerful piece of music on so many levels that became something that would... I describe it as a song about regeneration that constantly regenerates itself. Mm-hmm. And it's probably unique in that respect that, you know, what he's trying to say in the song, that was the river, this is the sea. So the past is gone, you know, the present, the future, this is where you need to be. This is perfect for a memory song, because if you go through your life and you play this at 15 or 25 or 35 or 45, it means something completely different, and you're always on the threshold of the next thing. So I think that's the ultimate sort of memory song for me, you know.
Yeah, I have to be honest with you, I didn't really know that song until I read this book, and I dug out that song, and it is a really beautiful piece of music, and just lyrics as well are just incredible. And obviously I was listening to that song in the context of your book and realized that, you know, your book is split into two, the first part being the river, the second part being the sea, perhaps. But, you know, that's kind of what I read into it a little bit there.
Yeah, totally. No, I haven't thought of that in that sense, but that's true. It is, mm-hmm. you know, it's where that sort of, you know, moving from a small town, Hitchin, where we were in Hertfordshire, and moving to the city, that is, you know, it does feel completely daunting, this thing of moving to the big city with no connections, no contacts there.
Yeah.
No, I think because someone pointed this out to me when I was writing the book, and I was thinking, well, not everyone's formed a band and moved to London, but they were saying, no, don't worry about it, because it's universal, because a large majority of people, you know, need to move out of the town they're born into and move into the adjacent big city, mm-hmm. to make headway into whatever, you know, whatever profession they're going to start at. So it's a well-worn story, but one I think that hopefully resonates. You know?
Let's move on to another song actually, which is a memory song, and I would like to sort of hear what this song conjures up, which is "Motorcycle Emptiness" by the Manic Street Preachers.
It was my way into the Manics musically, because I loved their interviews. They've been in the music press, sort of walking the talk for about a year. They were totally different to everyone else. They looked phenomenal. And, you know, they've done these interviews. They've done a little interview on Snub TV, which is a tiny little indie TV show. Yeah, it had this reach, you know, people would see it. And you'd have Richie and Nicky sort of talking in these beautifully modulated Welsh voices about doing terrible things to their contemporaries who they absolutely hated. And it really made sense of their interviews, because in cold print, it looked quite callous, you know, but here they were, and you think, right, I really get it now. This band are really interesting. They've got these contradictions. They look amazing. But I couldn't find a song. I thought that the music press weren't on their side at this point. You know, they didn't have the songs or maybe a melody, a sort of commercial melody. So they weren't really being taken seriously. And I remember, distinctly remember hearing "Motorcycle Emptiness" on a thing called Greater London Radio. And the big production and this gorgeous tune B guitar riff and the descending line underneath it. I think, who's this? Gosh, you know, this sounds, it sounded commercial. It was very, very highly machined as a record, but it had something else. And then the words came in, and it was just this torrent of sort of motifs and reference points and very disturbing stuff about culture, alienation, despair, and suicide. Mm. And then this beautiful chorus. I mean, it was really the standout song of that year, apart from Suede, the Drowners, you know, and they'd done this song that had so many things that were sort of pulling at each other. You know, there was a classic rock thing there, yet there were these nihilistic references. It was just so exciting to hear that for the first time.
And of course, the ultimate portal band, I think, are the Manic Street Preachers. They've sent me into so many rabbit holes that I've been very hard to climb out of. And that is a little catalyst, actually, of a song in terms of a portal song as well, because there's so much going on in there. The sad thing is about that song is that when they released it, they couldn't even play it live because they were still playing in these shitty venues and they're still playing with crap amps and guitars. while, so they couldn't even play that song live at the time, which is a real shame.
Yeah. I mean, they probably wouldn't have done it justice. I mean, I remember reading a story that they'd had Philip Hall, who was their manager and also was involved in our press company at one point before he sadly died at a very young age. He was very keen on this song, Motorcycle Emptiness. And I remember reading that, you know, the Manics were very keen on putting this out as the first single, but he said, I may have got this wrong, but he or someone else said, look, just keep this back, keep it back to the fourth or fifth single, you know. And they were so right, because it was just, it had, you know, they'd established themselves, and then they pulled this out, which anyone in any group's repertoire would be your best song, you know, but far and above anything else, you know. But yeah, just to spin back to the Portal sort of aspect, yeah, they were the ultimate band because of their manifesto stating all these different artists and writers.
One more song I think I just want to touch on, because this is kind of a fresh hold song for me. I was 16 when this was released, but Common People by Pulp was kind of that first song that launched me into Britpop. So it was a pretty big song for me at the time. What do you remember about that song?
This was it was the turning point for their career, for Pulp's career, but it was the turning point for me getting into the band, and it probably was for many others too. But I had a slightly ambivalent attitude towards Pulp because they seemed to they just weren't serious enough for me. Because that would be totally fine now, but I think at the time a few people said, "Well, are they?" They seem like a sort of joke band almost, you know, like Jarvis is doing these moves that looks like a sort of parody of a 60s singer. And they had a couple of songs. They had, you know, Babies, which is really good, and Lip Gloss. And then this song, and I hadn't heard it on the radio, so it arrived as this sort of, I saw it on Top of the Pops when it was already number two. And it arrived as that sort of perfect sort of pop cultural moment, you know, like this sort of Starman moment must have been for the previous generation on Top of the Pops. You know, you see it, it's all there, perfect, the whole stall is set out. And it became the sort of the zeitgeist, the sound of the summer. You know, it was just everywhere, and everyone was wearing the shades on top of their head like Jarvis. I mean, it really was. They became my favourite, because I did, in the book, in Memory Songs, I slightly sidestepped Blur and Oasis because they didn't really, they just didn't get to me as much. But with Pulp, you know, after this moment, after Common People, such an astonishing, the lyric is just astonishing, you know, as it keeps building and building. I just thought, well, this is beyond the scope of any other writer active, you know, Damon included, you know, no one, this is, you know, they've raised everyone's game here, you know.
And the song structure of that is quite odd because of what you said there. It builds. It doesn't really do this chorus, you know, verse, chorus, verse thing. It just continuously builds, which is something very new, I think. Well, new to me at the time, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've just sort of seen it. There's a slight resemblance, a slight sort of DNA similarity to this and this. To This Is the Sea. In the two songs, in the fact that they're just a sort of force of nature, they keep building on a simple idea towards a sort of, you know, until it can't build any further. You know, they're epic songs, but yeah, you know, you haven't got this huge chorus that it keeps coming back to. It's just.
But let's move on to the second part of the book, because this details your move to London, and this was in the early 90s. Is that correct? Kind of in the late 80s, early 90s.
To pursue
your ambition to become a musician. So how did that feel to move away from your home and start what could be termed, better or worse, your own adult life?
Well, it was terrifying at first. As I think I mentioned, it was just, you know, we had no context there, no idea of how to even find a flat. How do you find a flat? You know, you look at ads in shop windows, and then, oh, someone said that you could find a flat from the Evening Standard, you know, so you go there. It was just sort of finding your way, you know, pre-internet with no sort of map. I mean, I think I was really lucky to not have to do it on my own, because I had my brother. We had this sort of common purpose. We were very young and zealous and idealistic, and everything was about the band. And, you know, if he suspected I wasn't putting in the hours songwriting, there'd be hell to pay. And, you know, we were just absolutely committed to somehow making a record, but completely clueless about how to go about it. And knew nobody at all. And it was quite a sort of parched, desolate period when you look at, or London was at that time. It was still sort of had a bit of a whiff of the 80s about it. You know, the money hadn't arrived in terms of, you know, there was still a recession going on. It was hard to do anything really. And what I found really interesting, actually, and maybe I'm jumping the gun a bit here, is I was just reading Brett Anderson's book. Really, they were doing the same thing, just in another part of London. They just didn't have a clue. They didn't know anybody, you know. And his book, I think, really evokes what it was like at that time. He goes into a lot more detail about, signing on, just being completely out of step. That was the feeling at the time, being out of step. And when's this?
Yeah, and of course as well, your early drummer did end up in Suede.
Yeah, so Simon Gilbert was he with us very well, not that briefly. I think we did about 6 months, and we had a band called The Shade. And he was, I think, there's a Suede biog out there that lists his. Lists all his bands, and we were his 12th band, and Suede were his lucky 13. So we were his unlucky 12. Yeah, I mean, I say in the book, he was a lovely guy, you know, and just waiting, I think, for the right band to come along. And we did. We worked hard. And I think at that point, you know, Suede, I mean, apart from you know, having Bernard Butler on guitar, you know, Suede, they had a manager, and that was, it's, you weren't going to get anywhere without a manager. So that was that little, you know, and that's my into the book. The intro of the book finds me watching, you know, from having seen Simon a couple of years before or a year before, suddenly seeing him on Top of the Pops as the best new band in Britain. You know, it was quite a spur to kind of really get on with it and try and do something.
A lot of books that I've read, I read a lot of music biography. I've not read Brett Anderson's yet, and I do want to at some point. But there is that talk of like moving to London to become big, to be where the music scene is. And it always seems so easy. And your book makes it seem like that was an easy move too. But like, do you think it's harder now for bands who are just coming up to make that move?
It's interesting. I really wouldn't know. I really would. I mean, I think it depends on your background. There's a lot been made for the past few years about the majority of musicians now, you know, so what, there's a stat, isn't there? Something like, you know, 25 years ago, 20% of the musicians were privately educated. Mm-hmm. Now it's 80% or something. So if you've got that kind of that safety net, it's a lot easier to do it. You know, it's a lot easier to be able to sustain yourself and create the art that you so want people to hear. But on the other hand, I mean, I do know a couple of artists who are 20 years younger than me, and it's incredibly difficult now. Maybe it's always been that way, but they're having to create a lot of the buzz themselves. They're going off and putting up YouTube channels and things like this. And, you know, there's obviously Twitter, which has made it, in one sense, it's made it a lot easier to disseminate your music. But that kind of fracturing, that unraveling, has made it a lot harder, because there's not this central focus. There are not three music papers and Radio One, where you have to be in and you get this huge exposure. Now, you could have, you know, a million YouTube hits and still not have a record deal, you know. So I'm sure it's just as hard now in its own way.
In the book, you talk about the experience of making your first record with Flamingos. But at times, that story that you tell in that book, it doesn't come off as particularly positive. So what went wrong in the making of the record, and how did it affect your desire to become or remain a working musician?
Yes. Well, we had the classic sort of the snakes and ladders thing, where we were already signed to Elektra, which was fine by us because it was an amazing, legendary record label. And they pulled their operation out of the UK and our deal collapsed. So we ended up signing with this indie label who didn't have a huge amount of experience at marketing guitar bands. And it all sort of unraveled after that. I mean, I guess I'm slightly uncharitable in the book to the label, and really no one forced us to sign to them. And it must be remembered as well that we were hot-headed young men. We were arguing amongst ourselves. We couldn't agree on anything. And it all becomes so overheated and important. You know, we left our education behind, and this was our 20s. This was our life. It had to work. It all becomes so silly, really. So that the recording process sort of unraveled. And in that sense, it is a little bit like sort of other rock books you may have read, where it kind of all goes a bit pear-shaped in the studio. What we ended up with, though, was an album that we were really proud of, and I can still listen to it today. I'm still proud of it, and I'm amazed that we got anything out. But what happened at the end of that process was we were just exhausted, really. We should have had a rest. We've been hammering away for the last 10 years. That's sort of where the book ends is around that time when the band just implodes. And we had the usual ego things that all bands have. You know, being in a band with your twin brother brings
it. That must have been That must have been tough.
Yeah, but it was like we were the thing. Oasis were emerging at the same time. The thing that was really interesting with them is that they made their fights. They made all the fights into a USP. And something that would become a sort of soap opera. But we were fighting like cat and dog, but we were so, fearful that our manager would see this and people wouldn't want to work with us because there's division within the band. We didn't realize that the best thing to do was to make it public. But, you know, we'd be having this big old sort of, ding-dong in the rehearsal room. And we'd be like, quick, the manager's coming back, you know. We didn't really sort of see the press value in that,
So let's move into the kind of writing of the book. Did you find any difference in writing a book compared to, say, writing a song?
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought about this on and off because, I mean, it's not the book is narrative nonfiction, so you're dealing with characters and emotions as you are in songwriting. So that's useful. I think there's a lot to learn from songwriting also in the sense that, when you front load a song with a hook, this draws the listener in, and you can use the same technique with chapters. And also the fact that because each chapter is kind of self-contained in a sort of essay form, really. So I think the song form is quite similar to the essay form. You start at a point A, and you go off in your mad discursive, ride wherever you want to go, and then you return to sort of point B at the end of the song. And this is very similar, I found, to the essay form or the chapter form.
When you finished the book's manuscript and you were handing it over to the publisher, did you all of a sudden like have that facepalm moment where you just felt, oh my God, I've left out so-and-so band, so-and-so song? Were there any glaring omissions from the text?
I did, and the glaring omission for me was Mark Bolan and T-Rex, because I think I mentioned them. I think there's a reference to them in every single chapter. I'd have to go back and verify that. But I just thought that there might have been room for a really killer Mark Bolan T-Rex chapter, because he was so... Like the brief that I set myself was the music that fed into or informed or shaped Britpop. Mm-hmm. There's a huge amount of Mark Bolan's influence as an English artist there. But, it's maybe it's best that I didn't, because I was also aware of not being too obvious with the bands. I mean, there could have been a really killer Smiths chapter because they were so important to Britpop. But I thought, stick to... stick to the ones that really I really found myself writing about first, and also maybe the more esoteric ones. I mean, for instance, for me, the real anomaly in the book is the chapter on the Triffids, the Australian band, mm-hmm. So Triffids, 80s band, and I was really unsure of that. And when I handed the book over to the publisher that moment, as you just said, I was truly expecting them to say, you know, love it, love it, love all the Bowie, but cut the Triffids. And the publisher, Matthew at Unbound, who's a brilliant music fan, the first thing he said to me was, I love the Triffids. This is my favorite Triffids song. Oh, thank you, you know. And another thing that has happened with this chapter is that people may not know the Triffids, but a sort of a weird kind of superimposition is taking place. It's like, that chapter said so much to me, but the band wasn't the Triffids. It was actually, for me, it was the Sundays and reading, writing, and arithmetic. Mm-hmm. So they've taken something and put their own band over the top of it, which I found was fascinating. So I'm quite happy that the Triffids are in there, because they were sort of, you know, one of my pet bands, but you know, where do they belong in a book on Britpop?
Mm-hmm. So one of the aspects of the book that I really enjoyed whilst reading it was the ability to see similar situations that had occurred in your life that also happened in my own. And the difference was that I could place my own songs to match my own memories. So was this in some way deliberate? Did you want the reader to think about their lives whilst reading the book in musical terms?
No, I didn't. I never thought that, and I didn't. I just had no idea that kind of transference would take place. And it's really, really gratifying to hear that, because I thought I was being extremely, and probably was being extremely self-indulgent and just writing about stuff. I mean, one of the things for me was I wanted to write a book. I wanted to write about my favorite bands. So mm-hmm. I wanted to write a sort of book that I would read myself, that I would pick up in a bookshop, you know. So I was being quite selfish writing about this stuff, and I didn't know that transference could take place. Yet when I think about it, I've probably done the same thing myself in other mm-hmm. books, you know. It's a very interesting two-way street that happens between a writer and a reader. If the book's working, it's a kind of conversation in a way. It's a fascinating thing.
Oh yeah, and you know, your friend Duke, who was a guy who was, you know, a little older than you, a little wiser, a little more cooler, maybe. You know, I had a similar guy, you know, in my youth as well, who introduced me to music, drinking, smoking, you know, those kind of things. And so I immediately placed my own guy on top of him. And this, you know, the situations unfolded. But, you know, it was interesting that instead of your music, which obviously is important to you, I could put my own music on top of it. So I was like soundtracking my own kind of memories there. So that was it was a really neat thing. I'm interested in Unbound, their publishing model. So could you tell us a little bit about Unbound and how that differs in other ways and its advantages, disadvantages, if any?
Yeah, so Unbound are, they're a small independent publisher, but the key difference is that they require the physical costs of producing the book to be crowdfunded by the author. So in all other respects, they're a small, getting bigger, independent publisher, and they have, you know, their distribution is Penguin Random House, so that, you know, you are in the bookshops, you know, you're in Waterstones. They have, you know, staff, they have PRs, they have, you know, they have all the publicists and the editors and sort of real top level of staff, you know, people who've been in publishing for years, they really know their stuff. Yet this is one thing where, you know, the author, they've got to crowdfund the book, and it's hard work, and they're very upfront with you at the start of this process. There's a workshop for all the writers, and they say, you know, you've got to get in there and just find your inner hustler. Mm-hmm. I remember them saying, you know, you've got to find your readers, and it's really tough. It's because, you know, a lot of artists, a lot of writers aren't the most garrulous salesman, and it's hard to do that thing, and sort of, you know, knocking on the door of of, you know, uncles that you haven't seen for 20 years to ask them for 20 quid. You've got to do it. You force yourself to do it. And the other thing that it does is it forces you to find a readership or a fan base on Twitter, sort of person by person. This takes a huge amount of time and work, but what you're looking for is your natural reader. So that was hugely useful, you know, because by the time the book comes out, you've got 1,500 people, hopefully, who are sort of sort of like-minded and, you know, maybe want to pledge for the book and maybe want to, you know, read more of your work. So how it works is that, they open the sort of pledging. You have different pledge levels. You know, you have basic sort of incentives and things, and people pledge for that until the book's funded. And it's not like a Kickstarter where there's a cutoff point. I mean, it will keep going on until, I mean, sometimes the authors withdraw because they're exhausted the process. But the book's funded and it can take 2 years, and it's an amazing process, you know. And I think this, I mean, it's actually an old, Unbound King, to point out, it's an old model, you know. Dr. Johnson and, you know, Dickens and Voltaire, they had books that they crowdfunded. So it's not a new idea. What's good is that it gives them, the publisher, quite a lot of freedom. There's no risk involved, essentially, for them, you know. So they can publish titles that a big house probably wouldn't touch, you know, because there's too much risk. So it's quite a sort of revolutionary in its own small way.
It's a really interesting approach to publishing. What was your approach to it, and how long did it take? So what kind of activities did you kind of engage in to get this funding, and how long did it take?
I think it took about a year all told, it was a question of trying to sort of look for your ideal or natural reader. There was various sort of pledges, pledge levels with the book. I was quite lucky in the fact that I could, the very highest pledged level was, you know, we'll put the band together, back together, and we'll play a gig in the living room. And there were a few takers for that. I have to say, we haven't honoured, we've only done one of those gigs. That was, you know, those sort of high-end pledges really helped get a book off the ground. I mean, they have some of their writers, they may also teach creative writing, so they can put things like workshops up there. And I know that I took that idea, and I had a songwriting workshop that I offered. So it's these sort of experiences rather than stuff.
So we're just coming to the end of the interview here. So thank you, James. I would like to ask what you've got lined up next. Are you writing another book? Are you involved in any music projects right now?
I'm not involved in any music projects, no. I mean, the thing, it's all full-time writing now, really, that my brother and I are doing. He's a novelist now, and he reviews a lot. I've got some ideas, an idea for my next book. And I'm trying to do, you know, a lot of freelance work and getting in on the reviewing side and stuff. So writing all the way now, I think. I don't have the itch to create songs anymore, which is odd, but you do hear the odd one. And I think I try to leave a bit of hope at the end of Memory Songs that it's not, you know, the future hasn't been cancelled, but every now and again you will hear a song like a video games or something, or that you were good on the dance floor. You know, you hear a song, you know, it's what that art form, that 3 minute art form has still got life in it. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's harder the older you get, I think, as well. It's easy to become quite curmudgeon about music as you get older, because obviously, as Memory Songs kind of entails, it's you kind of reserve nostalgia and for the past, where it's hard to kind of break into the future a little bit, but there's still great music out there for sure.
Yeah, it's just harder to find because there's no one pop music. You know, it started to unravel 20 years ago. But yeah, it's still out there, and getting older. Yes, you know, we can all say, "Oh, it was better in our day," But interestingly, you mentioned Duke. I mean, I still know Duke, and he's the same. He's absolutely burns CDs. He's absolutely into whatever the esoteric sort of music of the day, and he just hasn't changed. He hasn't lost the, you know. So it's out there if you've got the appetite, you know.
Oh, for sure it is. Well, listen, James, thanks ever so much for joining me today and talking about memory songs. Wish you the luck for the future, man.
Thanks very much.